Welcome to Poets West, coming to you from KSER 90.7 FM in Everett, Washington. This is your host, J. Glenn Evans, and we bring you poems, stories, music, and occasionally an interview. We first met today's poet, Martin Marriott, more than 10 years ago, when he participated in Poets West's first public performance. One of the poems he read, we never forgot.
Little big man, to mark his third birthday. Little Tito, 3 years old, knows no better, so drops it, knocks it, spills it, stands up in the wreckage then, stands up in his brave innocence, and reassures us, saying, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." But the charm of this declaration, he makes it so. But there is more, and we know it. He brings us back, with eyes and voice, to a child's undefeated truth. Yes, it's okay, it's okay. He tells us what he knows, and that we have forgotten. That to say, this is broken, is only to say, this can be fixed. And if the boy can't fix it, he wouldn't know where to begin. Then his words are all the braver, all the truer. Youth is the age of courage. We always knew this, yet we doubt ourselves. But when Tito believes in us, that we can remember, that we can understand, then we love him, and we grow wise to meet him.
Martin Marriott immigrated to the United States a number of years ago. He is a house painter by trade, and on weekends he is a poet, artist, and musician. As a hard-working guy and poet, he identifies with working people wherever they are to be creative and to their own stories. Well, Martin, what part of England were you from?
From Manchester in the north of England.
Did you live right in town? Or?
It was a place full of unemployed alcoholics.
Sounds like a good start. Is that why you came to the United States?
I was one of the huddled masses yearning for freedom.
And did you come here alone?
That's a very, very personal question. I fell in love with an American woman. Let me rephrase that, since poets should pay attention to language. I was infatuated and misunderstood that. Believed it falsely to be love. I've since then edited that poem, aka a divorce.
Understood. When did you start writing, and or how old were you when you did start writing? And how did you get started writing poetry?
As well as being the most terrible place on earth, Manchester, England, there's also a very strong existence of working class cultural life carried out through the art of conversation, so people talk to each other. Also, I was fortunate enough to come of age, as they say, before every bar had 10 TV stations blasting out sports channels. So, like my father and like his father, I would gather with my peers, otherwise known as buddies or pals, in bars where we would talk about music, politics, the opposite sex, jobs, future, and so forth, the things that the nuts and bolts of life. So the art of conversation and of talking and of joke telling, and for those most talented might learn a musical instrument from a local band. Some of them might become quite well known. You may have heard of Joy Division or Smiths, John Cooper Clarke, The Fall. Others of us would start our working class occupations, officially told we're stupid, but of course being far from it. But often not expressing ourselves in any way that a sculptor or a painter or a musician might on a recording, create something called art. But our lives were art. Of course, under capitalism, art for the working class generally has a large element of dark humour as well as beauty.
Well, were there any particular poets, living or dead, who moved you to poetry?
Well, I wrote my first poem when I was living in the States in my 30s, so I went a long time as a human being without writing a single poem. But things start coming back to you once I started writing poetry here. My first poem was when I received the news from England that my father was dead. I flew back to England for the funeral, had a little talk with him over the casket. He was quiet because he was dead, so I could get more words in. than previously. So I won that one. I got one over on the old bastard. I've heard he still feels sore about that conversation. But seriously, when I'm flying back, I wrote my first poem, which is about the funeral and my feelings and resolving that whole father-son. You know, turning a sort of superficial hate into a functioning love often takes a death, unfortunately, to do that with things like fathers or bosses. You can forgive them their sins when they can't sin no more. Oh, the question, yes. So when I started writing poems, the first one about my father, I remember the first couple of lines, I just sort of opened a book and started writing. It's very strange, you know. I just felt compelled. So when you have very strong emotions, things about death or love, or hate, I guess, for it to come out in something called poetry. So I opened this book and wrote, "Bright flowers boast, and a smug crucifix leaning against the door smokes a cigarette." Well, I'd never talk that way. I don't talk that way. You know, that's not what you chat about in Seattle over a latte, is it? Don't use language in that way. But when I had this strong emotion that needed to be released, it came out in this sudden way with those things that professors then call alliteration and rhyme and repetition and so forth, that things come out with their own music. So I started carrying on writing. I got the bug, I got the taste of it. And then I remembered that when I was 18, you know, many years earlier in Manchester growing up with my mates and stuff, one of my favourite performers was a poet. I've forgotten all about him. And he was a poet who went around the pubs, around the bars, and did his stuff. And so that was kind of nice to touch home base. All the soldiers with their faces blown off. Because it midnight is, I left her in a car made of milk. She was drunkenly pushing ferns into the ears of small boys. And the faces at the dirty window of all the people I've hurt. I entered the convent. It was made of rat skins. I crushed 12 bishops there with my left hand, for I had fallen in love with a horse. I stole a dozen eggs for him. His coat was of meadow grass. Then I turned and saw my father rolling down a hill into darkness. Night is a bony ear. How thin the lake's door is, my parking lot, my sweet savage. He said, milk, being dust, is an orange, is an all-night radio. I said, Captain, I will squeeze through, always.
You know, Martin, this stuff seems to come out. It sounds like you're a natural poet. Do you do much revising, or is it basically you just polish it up a little and that's the way it goes?
The problem with editing is how to edit, of course, because you can edit to destroy everything that was the sincerity, an authenticity, and a naturalness, and a playfulness, and in a good spirit. If you edit it, like a university teacher, yes, then it'll no longer be yours. Because who's editing? Is it some kind of censor? Because we have enough problems. You know, people say, oh, I can't write poems, I can't dance, I can't play an instrument. We told this, there's a censor that says that we should just go to work, make somebody else rich, sleep, go back to work, and then die. And that we can't be creative. So we have to watch Seinfeld about millionaires. We have to listen to some corporation, what their labels tell us is music and so forth, and not make our own things. I think Bob Dylan said this, and he said, it doesn't matter who you are, every most famous artist, they're lying if they say that they're not very sensitive, that space where they create is a very gentle and sensitive space. You can be a big, tough guy, but if you're making art, that space in you is very delicate. And so you have to defend it from other people who want to bash it up. And you have to stop yourself from closing down as well. So for me, when we're editing is not to then become somebody else. Like imagine that when you're a kid, that teacher who scared the hell out of you, who marked you down as average or average to fair or poor, or told your parents you never amount to much. They're editors. They're censors. So you have to be very careful, I think, when you edit your own stuff, that you re-enter the piece. If you want to change the dance, you have to rejoin the dance and become the dance again. Yeah.
coats.
She fastened her coat and said, "We are living in a wound." He fastened his coat and said, "Yes, and we're in that wound, past our waists." She said, "Let's move out to the country. They still have fairgrounds there. And we can play at being pigs. And we can play at being horses. And we can play at being mountains. And we can play at being people. We can play at being flowers." And then she said, "What are you doing in there? You've been in there 10 minutes. And he said, "I'm writing a poem." And she said, "What's it about?" He said, "It's called The Country is a City with Less Buildings." And she said, "We can play at being streams, or we can play at being rocks, or we can play at being heart, we can play at being soul, we can play at being bodies, we can play at being earth, we can play at being sky." And then she said, "What are you doing in there? You've been in there 10 minutes. He said, "I'm rewriting the poem." And she said, "What's it about?" And he said, "It's called We Can Play at Being Wounded." And she said, "I know, we just did."
Some people say that writers are not made. They are born, and you can, by education, cultivate a certain talent. But I really believe the true writer has to be very sensitive to what is going on about him or her. Now, in school, when did you first get interested in poetry? And was there any particular poet that you really liked?
At school, you know, they give you some Jane Austen, this is in England, Shakespeare and so forth. Even something that's good, but how could you? If you're made to read something, you're told to read this, you're put in rows in a school and given this piece of paper and told to read it. I don't care how good that piece of paper is. You face an enemy. You've not gone out and looked around and chosen to read this. You've not wandered around or heard 10 poets. You know, you've not discovered it through self-exploration. You have it down. Just like the boss says, at 11 p.m, you'll be on that conveyor belt pressing that button. So the school teacher says, at 9 a.m, you will be reading William Blake. Now, I know how good William Blake, and he was a bloody serious guy. I'd give him some respect. But when he's taken as a weapon to intimidate young people, and then we wonder why everyone goes out of school saying poetry, that's got nothing to do with me, because I've only experienced it as being made to do it. So for me, I came out of school hostile to poetry. I knew once I'd left school, I was going to be working. I got a job in a plastics factory with a sander taking the burr off the edge of plastic buckets. And that's what most people do. And most people know that some teacher making a look at William Blake or Shakespeare has no connection with taking the burr off plastic buckets. No bloody connection at all. So I think that whether you find poetry like me in your mid-30s or you find it when you're 12, it's through your own initiative. At a certain point you totally can't dance and says, "Well, screw you, I can dance," and that kid will have a happy life. But it's through the self-confidence to go out and grab the things that you feel relate to your life. So I think that art, it can't be given by the schooling system. It can be something in you that looks at a painting and goes, "Yeah, that's my life," or, "Oh, isn't that curve beautiful?" But if a teacher insists it's beautiful, that's called police officers. And police officers have big sticks and they put in rooms for long periods of time.
What would be much more effective if they were to encourage the student to bring it out? Let them play. Mm-hmm. Trying to cram something else down your throat and forcing you to memorize it. I didn't really like poetry. Then one day, it came out like a flood, just like you. You're listening to Martin Marietta, whose humanity comes through as a spokesperson for the creative rights of working people. Martin also provided the music. This is a kind of a recap. Do you have any particular favorite subjects that you write about?
No. Question nails it, really. Love. Love. But that doesn't mean all just sentimental, squelchy things. I mean, what is the colour of love? I mean, how many colours are there? And what if you view all the colours? Obviously, bright red is love. What about gold? What about green? What kind of green, you know? Grey, I mean, love has to survive through grey. Nursing someone to their death, well, isn't there a grey in that loyalty? And these kinds of things. So, I'm sure everything I write is different, also I wouldn't want to express it. But without love, there is nothing. I mean, you might do the blues, you know, but the blues is the lack of love, and so love is in it too. Blues means you know what love is, and you look at the distance between potential and reality, things like that. It's all about love. But being human, which usually involves others, unless you're very narcissistic, they involve others. And I think one thing an artist starts to cultivate is an awareness of the depth of their feelings for others. Because you can easily get distracted and not have time to really feel anything. Like, you know when you go in a mall and you buy the food and the shopping and stuff, and you want to get out fast, and there's been music playing the whole time, and it's kind of familiar music. But when you walk out and someone says, what songs were they playing? You don't really know, because you weren't really listening. It was kind of familiar and kind of pleasant and reassuring because you knew it. Your mind was on the cans and the, you know, getting the cheapest soap out and so forth. So you're busy. Feelings can be like that too. You can be too busy working two jobs, too busy being anxious about something, worried about the future, being nervous for your kids, scared, insecure about your home, and angry at your own personal boss, things like that. These things can just take over your life. And so you don't sort of hear the music of feelings. So I think that's something that art helps. About daily deaths as well. The daily, your light goes out a little bit. When you're invited round to see a newborn baby, the energy and the glow that comes off that baby. If you're not careful, get clever and skilled, making the choices that will keep you alive, alert, then that light can go lower and lower and lower. And you got to rescue it every now and again, don't you? So I think everything about love, really. Love, life, about the flame. And how the flame is bigger than you might always feel that it is when you get pushed down by others. This starts with a quote from Rumi, which is the title. Beyond thought, there is a field. Will you meet me there? Sweet melt Godiva's horse, and he is horsetop, sliding gently into field. Lady Ethiopia, I am starving for you. How the flowers talk at railroad stations. How the flowers talk at bus terminals. How flowers lean into each other over the tarmac road. They put their bendy arms around each other. There is no lake like this lake, which is the world. Purple sky. Green raindrops where our feet were. The world is not very big. And there is only room in it for our love. I suppose soldiers will frost the spring and tranquilized windows, but Christ, the grass, the solemn cathedral of our bodies, humanity stretching out its arms, here in the forbidden corner and there in heaven. Lady Ethiopia, we are starving for you. And the purity of lips, when they're not wasted on speech, and all the pianos that we hide in.
What do you find most important in your, you know, literary work? Also, how do you feel about art in politics? Do you think it has any effect?
I think, ballpark speaking, no one's ever really improved on the 1940s, he said, I'm paraphrasing, but he said basically this, poetry has never stopped a single war. Yet men die every day for lack of what is to be found inside poetry.
It was William Carlos Williams who wrote along those lines. In other words, people do die, but without poetry, we die more miserably. Maybe a poem doesn't make anything happen, but then neither do the dead.
So I don't personally have any illusions. You know, there's a lot of money behind these big political parties. There's a lot of big corporate money, and they want to push their fingers around the globe, and they want to push their fingers into our lives, make us all as poor and obedient as they can, you know. Well, a poem, I love poem, wow. Do you remember that thing in China, Tiananmen Square? You know, the Chinese tanks rolling through Tiananmen Square, and that one guy standing in front of the tank. So it's pretty tough, I think a poem can do that. But the only definition of dignity is human solidarity. It's our ability to communicate with each other, to think things through collectively, to feel for the other people. So the cultural level, the question of keeping your humanity, the newspapers will never give you that, the TV will never give you that, the boss, the foreman, the general, they want you to just do what you're told. They want you to stop being human and become part of a machine, a replaceable part of machinery. So your human sensitivity, your feelings, your potential to give to others, to love and so forth, the finer things in life, the things that aren't just bits of machinery, poetry. And it's not just poetry. When you see a great movie, don't you say, oh, it's a really poetic film, or you hear a piece of music, say certain lyrics or a certain way that he said that phrase, you know, and you go, whoa. That song was poetry in it. So I wouldn't say poetry just as in how people think of it at school, but poetic singer-songwriters, poetic films. Yeah, we need that because we've got to stay human. If we don't stay human, we're going to do what they want us to do in the coming depression, which is to tear each other apart and fight like dogs over dwindling resources. But the more we can stay human, we can look out for each other. We've got to look out for each other. And we need hearts, and we need feelings, and we need sensitivity to look out for each other and not fight each other like dogs.
Now that sounds like a poet talking. We've talked about your poetry. Are there any other forms of writing that you participate in?
Comedy. I love jokes. Want a joke of mine? People say, because it's true. Someone said to me recently, Martin, you sure do swear a lot. And I said, well, that's because I'm from a very poor background. I said, when we were growing up, our parents were so poor, they couldn't afford to give us real words. My sister's 2 years older than me. One day she said, Dad, why can't we use adjectives and pronouns like the other kids at school? My dad said, listen, you'll use swear words and you'll like it. And we did.
Come. Come. Come, my beloved. Come, my sweetheart. Come. Don't talk about the journey. Say no more. Say no more of the path. We must take, you are my path, you are my journey, come, come, you stole from this earth a bouquet of roses, I am hidden in that bouquet, come, as long as I am sober, talking about good and bad, I am missing, seeing your face, I must be a bore. You are my path, you are my journey, come. Thank you. long inch of this night. Our fine fins flutter. Flowers from the rooftop secret orifice. The hand grenades. The lipstick. How many acres in a mule? High this town, in the big hill, beneath the abandoned granary.
Two John Travoltas. The Dancing Disco in the Blue Moon Tavern. The Dancing Disco in the Blue Moon Tavern. The Dancing Disco in the Blue Moon Tavern. And someone better call up Allen Ginsberg real fast. If he can find Jack Kerouac, round up Henry Miller, and some other very dead people, maybe they can still save the day. But I don't think so, no. You see, I was in the Blue Moon last night, and there was a guy there with a white beard down fully to his waist, and a very strange hat, and a face all washed out from doing drugs in the 60s, and he was teaching me how to dance disco. One beer, and I was there. I was dancing disco in the Blue Moon Tavern. We knew what we were doing, and that's partly why we laughed, as we sang "I Will Survive" in the Blue Moon Tavern. We were kicking out the cobwebs, burying the dead, making everything possible. And everything's possible when you're dancing like Travolta in the Blue Moon Tavern. The door was wide open. We could feel the night air. But the disco ball was flashing and we were still laughing. Two John Travoltas in the Blue Moon Tavern.
You've been listening to Martin Marriott, poet, musician, artist, hardworking house painter, and an eloquent spokesman for the working people everywhere. Martin also provided the music. Well, if somebody out there in Radio Land wants to have their house painted by a poet, how did they get in touch with you?
And my email is Marriott_Martin@hotmail.com. Marriott, same as the hotels. And if you think I talk fast, wait till you see me paint.
Very good, very good. This series is a production of Poets West in the studios of KSER 90.7 FM in Everett, Washington. We welcome your comments and questions. You can email us at info@poetswest.com. That's PoetsWest.com. Everything you want to know about poetry and poets in the Northwest can be found on our website, poetswest.com. So until next time, this is J. Glenn Evans for Poets West.